north and became Scots, and the obtuse angles turned left and became English. That was it.
I knew I'd never get the last word.
Well, that's the advantage of the chair. Robert, just one question. We're not going to sort of question people as we go through, but just to clarify, you were saying the sort of 19 bases or whatever they were. Are you quite happy with that, or would you want to shrink them anyway?
The microphone back again. I think we felt that the presentation of historical costs, I mean, essentially recoverable historical cost, which is talking about, is a little bit overcomplicated. I think that was being referred to down here, that actually some of these things, you know, it just depends what sort of thing you've got as to which of those bases are being used. So it felt perhaps labouring it a bit to have all those, however many, which were historical cost, because I don't actually think that, practitioners think that it's that complex. But I think setting out we've done it in our paper, setting out a menu of the major options and thinking as you plan to do of the how they measure up against the qualitative characteristics is perfectly good and shows an appreciation that there'll be pluses and minuses, and that inevitably will mean that which you want to use will depend on the circumstances.
Thank you. Ian?
Thank you. I have really quite similar comments to make to perhaps the last two or three people. Firstly, picking up what both Ian Wright and Robert Hodgkinson said, I think it's self-evident that different users will want different things from the same set of accounts. And in many cases, the different users, given free choice, might wish to pick different methods of valuation because they would see a particular valuation as the one that is most useful to them in particular. So that in itself suggests that, as other people have said, we're not going to find a right answer. But I think there's a second dimension to the difficulty of getting a right answer, and that is that with the possible exception of quite significant chunks of historic cost accounting, any other method of valuation is almost certainly subjective to some degree, or at least has some sort of inherent inaccuracy. Even if I take the price of one share of Unilever as quoted at the close of the market last night, the price I'll get for one share will be rather different than the price I'd get from 10,000, and different again from the price I would get from 10 million. And then there are issues over what the sales costs might be, and they won't be quite the same for me as they would be for you, or for Goldman Sachs as for BNP Paribas and so on. So in both cases, there are degrees of uncertainty. Now, I draw two conclusions from that. One, that there is no, from the fact that A, there is not necessarily a right method of doing it, and B, that whatever method you picked on is not going to give you an utterly precise, in some sense, correct number. The two conclusions I draw are, one, that in a funny way, it perhaps matters less than some of us might think which one you pick, because there isn't, in the end, the final right answer. But that leads on to the second conclusion, or the second corollary, which is that the most important thing, in my view, is to ensure or to provide as much information as possible to help all users of all shapes and sizes to understand what the limitations are of the particular number that they're looking at, how accurate or inaccurate it is, what assumptions implicit or explicit are there in getting to that number, so that the user is not led to some sort of false conclusion because they think there is some greater degree of accuracy in there than there really is. We had a debate in this room some weeks ago about how you value what I think of, still like to think of, as contingent liabilities. There are obvious examples with how you value all sorts of fixed assets. A large piece of special purpose plant that's making some big chemical process is quite a difficult thing to value in any meaningful sense. What is important is that the users don't think that there is some objective truthful value. Now, how do you do that in terms of providing information to the user, help the user? I think you do it in two ways. One is to make sure that the accounting standards themselves provide helpful information about the limitations of using a particular value. They do to some extent, some of the drafts do, but I get a bit concerned when, for example, some of the fair value stuff talks a lot, rather too much in my view, about the fair value. What I would like to see is a fair value. In most cases, I think there are lots of them. So the accounting standards should set out the limitations. That's at a general level. At a more specific level, in terms of disclosure, we should be trying to find ways of encouraging the producers of accounts to produce information which is helpful to the users in finding where the entity-specific uncertainties, inaccuracies, etc. are, so that the user gets some overview of the quality of the figures as well. But to go back to square one, there aren't any right answers, and it's much better we all recognise that.
Thank you, David. I ought to start, I think, by pointing out that while I'm Builders Independent, that doesn't mean I'm from the newspaper with that name. It means that I'm a retired finance director with a bee in his bonnet about measurement in reports. I really want to make 5 points. The first one is, let's not forget the purpose of financial reporting. And the second one is, how much do we like a mixed basis of measurement? The third one is, which bases are worth considering? The fourth one is, what is the form of the solution? And the fifth one is, which bases will figure in that solution? So let's not forget the purpose, really. I think apart from protection of investors, protection of debt creditors, the main purpose of our financial reporting is to allow investors to hold managements to account for their performance and thereby improve performance, therefore make us all richer and deal with the problems of the world that way. And by performance, I think we mean performance in value creation, of which performance in profit is part, but a relatively small part. Profit is really just harvesting the value that's already been created. So for me, there has to be a focus on value creation, because when you run public companies, you're in no doubt that that's what you're there for. The next question, how much do we like a mixed basis of measurement? Well, I'd rephrase this. I'd say the most important issue is to debunk the mixed basis of measurement. Mary Barth, in her paper about incorporating the future into accounts, I think does a very good demolition job on mixed basis of measurement, where she says it's conceptually unattractive and goes on to be confusing. And the issue, I think, with mixed basis of measurement is that the totals and subtotals in any reports that are prepared on a mixed basis of measurement are apples and oranges added together with no intuitive meaning whatsoever. Those totals represent no real-world economic phenomenon. They're not a faithful representation of anything. And you can consider, when there is a real basis of measurement, that those totals do mean something and the whole of the reports become meaningful. The other thing I think about a single or a defined basis of measurement is that it simply makes the standard setting process easier. Indeed, if you have a defined basis of measurement, arguably you can do without a lot of standards. And in my view, an awful lot of the troubles that we've had over the last 30 years about trying to agree on accounting standards are really about failure to have had any thoughts about basis of measurement, because the majority of accounting standards, I think, are about basis of measurement and how you use it in certain places. And I think if we are to debunk the mixed basis of measurement, I think there is a solution which will satisfy both those who want a mixed basis and those who really want a single value-based basis, which I'll move on to in a moment. When we look at the 19 or so bases, I think there are three that are worth considering. You know, an awful lot of them are kind of add together or throw them out. And the first one is, I'm not at all sure, Kevin, that there's one that's actually in your 19, but it's very widely used, the recoverable historic cost basis. I think we can all agree that the recoverable historic cost basis is fairly useless for listed companies on its own. But before we throw the baby out with the bathwater, we should not forget that almost all management accounts in almost all companies are prepared using the recoverable historic cost basis, so the information is there. Because it's the one that companies use internally, almost all cash forecasts, which I think we'll all agree are going to be important, are prepared on the basis and format of recoverable historic cost projected forward. And it is the de facto basis of preparation of external accounts in almost all companies in the world, in that most of those companies are small companies, private companies, that just do not understand and do not care about fair value accounting or anything of the sort. They're just going to do recoverable historic cost accounts. So the first one then is recoverable historic cost. The other two are actually very similar, fair value and value in use. They're very similar in that they come to the same answer in almost all assets and liabilities. The area in which they don't come to a similar answer is a very important one to do with fixed assets. And I'll come back to that difference in a moment. The solution, I think, or the third point, the solution, I think, is a dual basis. Imagine the balance sheet in which there are either a top half and a bottom half, or two columns, whichever way you prefer to think of it. The first column could be all assets and liabilities at recoverable historic cost. Just do accounting as we learnt at our father's knees and put those numbers out there. People that want to talk about stewardship and accountability, objectivity, auditability, can use those numbers because those are the kind of features of those numbers. And then your second column, or your bottom half, would be the accumulated value gain since time began to take you to the total line, which would either be fair value or value in use. So illustrate with an office building at cost 200, accumulated value gains 100, total fair value 300. You could do that as the format of a balance sheet. So the key question is, if you're going to have a dual basis in which recoverable historic cost provides the reliability feature, which of those two bases for value do we want? Do we want value in use, or do we want fair value? And the way I've considered it, the rather surprising conclusion that I've come to is that value in use is quite a lot more reliable than fair value, and it is much more relevant to users' needs. I've said already before that they're very nearly the same. The area in which they differ is fixed assets. And fixed assets are a very important area because it's a very large area, but this is where a fair value approach, particularly to level three valuations, will come to a different answer from a value in use approach. And the difference is that under fair value, you are required to consider what a market participant would do with your fixed assets, and under a value in use approach, you consider what you will do with your assets, and value in use is therefore likely to be a higher figure than fair value. However, the reason that fair value is less reliable is that managements of public companies are very, very familiar with value in use. Value in use is what you manage when you're managing a public company. Value in use is the value that you're trying to create. You put your effort into trying to improve those cash flows, reduce the weighted average cost of capital, improve things. So you know those cash forecasts that make up value in use. You've lived with them, you've got them well documented, they're very well audited. You probably give them to your credit rating agency and somebody checks them, because these figures just generally are available. So they are fairly reliable in the sense that they are very well studied and combed over. Fair value, on the other hand, would only be used at accounts preparation time, and following that you would throw them out because they've got no other purpose at all. You would make a guess at what a market participant would do with your assets, and at the end of the day, you cannot bring any science to those numbers. You'll just make a guess at what a market participant would do with your assets. So value in use is more reliable then. As to which is more relevant, I think the words are a bad description. When you think of a balance sheet that is made up entirely of fair value items, if you ignore what I think is the mistake that FAS 157 has made by making it a price rather than a net proceeds, then a fair value balance sheet would effectively be the value that you would expect to get on an orderly winding up, a member's winding up of the company. So you could think of fair value as the winding up value, whereas value in use is more the investment value, how much should you trade the share for or buy the company for on this basis. And clearly, the users are much more interested in what the value of the company is. So imagine accounts that are prepared on a value in use basis with a recoverable historic cost background, then you're, I think, dealing directly with investors' needs. But encouragingly, I don't think it matters that much. I think if we were to jump to fair value, I think what FAS 157 has done for us has given us a basis that can grow into the basis that we can all agree on. I think given an amount of time of using it, the gap between fair value and value in use is likely to narrow to the point where either will do quite well. So I would say that the most relevant and useful basis is value in use, but fair value comes a very close second. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil. Svetlana?
Thank you. Well, I was first wanted to comment that I was very pleased to see the questions which you're raising, and the first question you were raising initially as to which of the bases are relevant and whether which one of them is most appropriate. I personally believe that there are some, for example, some of the financial instruments which make sense to value at fair value. On the other hand, I personally don't see any relevance in valuing PP&E of oil company at fair value. That's my personal view. So in my mind, the question is where to draw the line, and I do appreciate that it's difficult in a principles-based accounting standards, but I really believe that is the question which needs to be answered as to where it is. And I know I'm oversimplifying the debate to historical cost versus fair value, but if we live in that model, I think this is the question I would ask. The next question, which I think we don't need to forget, is the reliability. And having read some of the ISB discussions, I think the belief, and at least my interpretation of the belief of the board, that if the information is relevant, then reliability is somewhat secondary. Again, I don't really believe that it's strictly speaking correct answer, because I think it comes the time when the information becomes so irrelevant that it becomes so unreliable that it becomes irrelevant. And I really think that it needs to be kept in mind as well. And lastly, I was just wanted to comment on your note that the ISB is not necessarily advocating fair value for everything, but I do find it difficult to agree to this comment, and I'm not trying to pick a fight, when the extractive industries working group is sent, apparently, and from reading the notes of the meeting, with a mandate that if they come again suggesting that the oil companies' PP&E should be valued at historical cost, they might as well just go away and think again. Because I think that, at least to maybe to laymen or to preparers, does sound like a matter of, well, you go figure out how to do it, as opposed to you go figure out of why this needs to be done, why it is relevant, and what is the most appropriate basis. So I think this is the right question to ask, and I'm really pleased that we're discussing the fundamental question of whether we need to do it and whether information on the fair value is relevant to start with, and then whether it can reliably be obtained.
Thanks, Svetlana. We might ask you about oil reserves later, but we'll pass on that one just now. Who was next? Andrew, and then Melissa.
Thanks, David. Well, first of all, I think it's a very positive step that the board has organised these roundtables, and I guess some others during the course of the day have suggested you ought to really nail down the objectives of financial reporting precisely before moving on to thinking about measurement, but I'm not in that place. I think all the phases of the conceptual framework project are clearly related to one another, and there might be a need to circle back around this discussion more than once, but nonetheless, you need to push forward on different fronts at the same time. So well done for that. I also think it's very useful and stimulating to put together the current inventory of measurement bases. I, like others in the room, might challenge whether some of these separate measurement bases are simply estimation techniques being applied to current measurement bases, but nonetheless, I think getting a bit of clarity of terminology is in itself going to be a big step forward in, hopefully, in the future, the board making optimal decisions in standards-level projects. Just back on the question of the objectives of financial reporting, I think we at Grant Thornton, I think most people would agree that being of some help in assessing future cash flows is an important objective of financial reporting. I guess what's perhaps more difficult is to decide exactly how useful a financial report ought to be in meeting that objective. And the current discussion paper acknowledges that a financial report isn't going to provide all the information that a user might need, but doesn't really go on to suggest just how big a percentage it might aim to strive for. We also believe that there is something around this accountability stewardship issue, which is not the same as just being useful in assessing future cash flows. What I would counsel against, though, is trying, just back on the assessment of cash flows, trying to make the balance sheet, or whatever it might be called in the future, work too hard in achieving that objective. There are greater limitations to balance sheets currently at present than the fact that there are different measurement bases applied to different items. It's a question more of what's not on the balance sheet rather than how it's measured. What intangibles aren't recognized will be the main thing. I think in meeting this usefulness for forecasting future cash flows objective, you need to take a holistic view at all the primary statements, the accompanying notes, and I think the MD&A, the operating and financial review, whatever that might be called, is also going to be crucial to actually achieving useful information in practice. In terms of what might be included in a framework in due course, I certainly don't want to in any way jump forward to the conclusion, but I would be surprised if there is a sort of preferred measurement basis or default measurement basis prejudged at the framework level. I think what's needed, what I'd expect to see, is more of a modernized, up-to-date, possibly rationalized toolkit for the board to draw on in assessing and selecting the optimum measurement basis at standards level. And I think what's needed to help the board get there is a balanced discussion of alternative measurement bases, which should include what you might call historical cost or transaction-based measurement. I think fundamentally, you can slice and dice the measurement bases different ways and identify different characteristics and pros and cons, but I think a fundamental question is, are we, in measuring a particular item on the balance sheet, trying to create a number which itself in isolation tells you something about future cash flows, or is actually just part of a process which leads to an information set which is useful in terms of delivering information about management performance, in arbitraging between its input and output markets, in establishing trends which can be extrapolated based on the judgment of particular users to actually deliver useful information in practice. As a starting point, I think for financial instruments, which are just contracts that embody cash flows, I can clearly see a strong argument for using a measurement basis which tells you something directly about those cash flows, because that's all there is. I know this is a generalization and not entirely true, but broadly those cash flows are independent of the activities of the entity, and so why not measure them just based on the expected cash flows on a value-in-use or fair value basis? For assets which are fundamentally going to be operated in the business, I think it is perhaps more about accounting for the costs incurred and finding an approach which allocates those costs to the period in which the entity derives benefits, and building up that transactional picture of the business to enable users to do their job in estimating the future cash flows. So that's very much a starting point. But overall, I welcome the project, welcome the rationalization of the measurement bases, but wouldn't expect the number to be reduced necessarily to small single figures. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. Melissa?
Excuse me, I'm trying very hard not to cough over here, so if I do, please excuse me. I'm Melissa Allen from Credit Suisse, and I'm here today representing ISDA, which our members include most of the leading financial institutions and major users of derivatives and derivative products around the world. So from that, many of our active members have financial assets and liabilities that are reflected on the financial statements today at fair value, either because they've been mandated by the standards or because we've elected to do so using the fair value option. So you would think that with this group of individuals, when we sit around the table and talk about going to full fair value, that if there's any group that could get there, this group could do it, given how far we've come at fair value already. But I have to say, from the discussions with our members, that's not the case. And instead, I think what we found is that while fair value makes sense for many assets and liabilities in many circumstances, we're not really convinced, even for financial instruments, that it makes sense for all entities under all circumstances. And I think, in particular, both for financial and for non-financial items, when we start to discuss those long-dated strategic assets and liabilities where there's no intent and sometimes even no ability to exit the position, there are questions around whether an exit price in that situation does make sense. Even for financial instruments, when we started talking about non-financial instruments, the conversation gets even more difficult. That said, in asking our members, both from the preparer side and also from the user side, our credit analysts and equity analysts, well, what do they want? The comments back were quite consistent. In particular, there were some things that everyone had consensus on, and one was that they felt that the assets and liabilities in the financial statements should reflect the way those assets and liabilities are going to be managed and used in the business, and making sure that that's aligned with the strategy for the company. And that does mean, just looking at financial instruments, for example, that one institution that, for example, holds a portfolio of loans, that their whole intent and purpose for having that is to securitize and sell them, may say that a current exit value makes the most sense, while another institution with a portfolio of loans for which they don't have the intent to exit that position may feel that an entry price value and not a current cost value makes more sense, even though they may look the same in principle. I guess the other thing that we also said across the board was that we felt that portfolios of assets and liabilities that are managed together, we would like to see on a consistent basis. That's one of the reasons why the fair value option has been so readily accepted, especially by financial institutions, is an ability to address some of the mismatches where we have assets and liabilities that are managed together, that when looking at the standards, that they may not be mandated accounting that is consistent. So being able to have those on the same basis was important. But I think also one of the key things that we talked about was making sure that regardless of the basis that you use, that you have transparency in the financial statements around how you've valued your assets and liabilities and why you've done that, why that makes sense for the different portfolios of assets and liabilities that you have, and being able to give the reader some information around what's been done and the impact that would have on the financials. We did talk also at times about having alternative measures sometimes disclosed in addition to the information. So you'd want to put your most relevant numbers in the financial statements, but perhaps if there's an alternative that would be important to the users, we would certainly be open to wanting to include that so that you have a full set of information that's beneficial to the users of the financial statements. I guess the only other point that overall we also had a consistency of view on is that even in a current value regime, we felt that entity-specific value in use was the most relevant value to have, i.e. knowing really the value that management believes that they have and will extract from it. So if you had a market value that management had no intent or ability in their current circumstances to realize, we didn't think that made the most sense to have reflected in the financials versus what truly is going to be realized with those assets and liabilities by the company itself.
Melissa? Leo?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for organizing this. We also think it's very important to discuss these more fundamental things in the framework. We also welcome very much the list of measurement bases. I now understand your comment better at the beginning that you weren't prejudiced on fair value because the term fair value does no longer appear in the list of measurement bases. But we think it is very important just also to get away from the confusion and agony about fair value, because at least now we understand that there are multiple fair values and how exactly you define them, and it also makes it important to discuss the relevance, like Ian already said, and also Andrew, what it actually means. And relevance would not just be looking at the different users, but also, even if users have the same information needs, it doesn't mean that relevance in terms of measurement base is the same for all assets and all liabilities. And so that brings us to the question of what is the unit of account? If you want to look at value in use, that says something about what you think the asset is you're looking at. If you talk about liabilities, what market are you looking at? Is it the market that's purely hypothetical or that's hardly used, or is it the market that is the most commonly used by the particular entity? So all these things do interact, and so you do need multiple measurement bases, at least in your framework, to be able to pick the one that is the most relevant, given the unit of account that is dealt with in the standard, and also the relevance in terms of what users want to do with this. And that means something for the framework. It's probably impossible to cut it down to just one measurement basis and use that across the board. But you have to take a couple of steps first
to determine what the unit of accounts, what the type of asset is, and what type of liability is. And maybe just as last remark, don't focus too much on financial instruments. There are a lot of corporates that are applying your standards, and it would be helpful for those corporates to, when you talk about these measurement bases, also make them understand what you actually mean in their environment and not just use examples from financial instruments. Thanks.
Leo, could I just ask you, when you were saying that it would depend on the assets and liabilities, the relevance, what sort of model have you got in your mind?
To me, it's a sort of a trade-off. If you want to present individual assets, that means that you may have to look at measurement bases that don't get you into the value in use that some of the people here would like the companies to use. If you think you have to go to value in use, that means that has presentation effects or disclosure effects, because that would basically means that at least you're looking at the cash generating unit as your unit of account. So there's a trade-off here. You can look at the cash generating unit and say value in use, but that means that you're losing some of the refinement in terms of what type of assets do you actually have, and what do you think you're going to do with it. The feeling I have is that it's better to look at the most relevant market and give something in terms of details of assets, instead of looking at details of assets and looking at the market that may not be very relevant to the entity. On the liability side, the same thing. If a company is looking at its at a settlement market, which is the market they normally use to de-recognize their liabilities, why would you be required to look at other markets that the company is hardly using?
Okay, we'll move on and just keep going around the table, but I know one or two board members will be wanting to ask questions. Paul and then Sue.
Thank you, David. When I read through the papers last week, I found myself thinking that it was regrettable that the board appeared to be putting off questions concerning practicality until the third stage. Equally, my reading of milestones 1, 2, and 3 was that it was only when you reached milestone 3 that we'd find ourselves in a discussion about whether or not you may need more than one measurement base. My concern about that was I felt that would lead us into spending yet more months in which we'd end up in a polarized debate about full fair value and the reasons why many around the table don't believe that gives you the answer that you're looking for. And I think my concern was partly created by looking at one of the articles that you attached to the website, or this part of your website, that very clearly sets out the statement that standard setters and others do regard fair value as providing the most relevant information to financial statements. I think what I've heard today, though, is that you are looking for much more of a discursive debate right from the outset of this dialogue. I think that it's extremely promising that we've heard so many people say that actually what we have to be spending our time doing is actually discussing the different measurement bases, getting an understanding of the relevance of the different possible bases. And I think that if that's what we take from today and your session in Hong Kong and the sessions that you have following this, then I think it means that we end up in a situation in which we can put our time to much better use, in that we can have a better understanding of the principles underlying the different measurement bases. And we can start to think about the issues that link the two, because I don't think that necessarily we find ourselves thinking that different parts of the balance sheet are mutually exclusive. There's clearly linkages between them. And it might be that if we accept that more than one base might have a relevance, then actually we can think about what are the circumstances in which you'd apply fair value, what are the circumstances in which you'd apply some of the alternatives, and also it might be that we can find ourselves spending some quality time thinking about the linkages between the two and the value of other tools that you have within the ISB toolbox. In particular, what is the value of the option and what can you do to spend the basis as a result of that? what can you do to better facilitate hedge accounting? And also, just how valuable is transparency, and to what use can you put the disclosures and complementary disclosures that people have a better understanding of the reasons why different parts of the balance sheet are measured on a different basis, and also the way in which people have applied options, whether it's under the fair value option or other optional bases, the basis on which people applied options that clearly they have available to them.
Okay, we'll come back to some of that, Paul, for me. Sue?
Yes, thank you. As many of you know, I spend most of my days trying to explain accounting to analysts. This can be extremely challenging, of course. Often I sort of, you know, just for fun, challenge myself and try to explain, you know, take a number on the balance sheet, say, and explain what is the meaning of that figure. It's just basic things like that. The analysts that I'm working with are credit analysts, so let's take an easy one, debt. What is the meaning of the number on the balance sheet for debt? They find it very confusing that there can be so many bases of accounting applied, you know, taking... I think we only have a few on the list here, but amortized cost is frequently applied. At times, companies will use fair value option, so a full fair value model. At other times, they will have adjusted the carrying amount for the fair value of hedged risk. Other times, they will have acquired the debt, fair valued it back in history, so now it's a bit of an amortized fair value. I think what I draw from this is something maybe to keep in mind as we go through this project. We need to be able to have understandable amounts on the balance sheet, and coming right down to line items and amounts, if different bases have been applied, I think we need a way of distinguishing that. We need to distinguish sort of the policies applied and how those actually are seen in practice, because analysts will be taking the amounts, income statement, balance sheet, cash flow statement, they'll be using those, but they need to know what they mean. And can we actually describe in a sentence what that number on the balance sheet means? I think that's something that's very important, that we look for relation between the policy and the practice. Some of it comes down to company disclosure and the clarity, and I think companies can probably, you know, many do a very good job, others can do better in terms of relating it in that way. I think as most people have said, we're very unlikely to come up with a single method that'll work for everybody and apply across the board. Very few of us would be in favor of open options, so that's no good. Random options in the eyes of an analyst is just not credible. I think, though, if we have clear disclosure of how policies are put into practice in the financial statements, what we then can think about is really empowering companies to select a meaningful basis and probably narrow down the range of options that could be applied. But, you know, maybe some companies it would make sense to value their portfolio of real estate at fair value. For others, maybe it's cost, a depreciated cost or something. There may be very good reasons why companies' management, you know, having to do with how they manage, what they're planning to do with the asset. I think we can empower them to make some of those decisions as long as we have clarity of what they've done, so that the accounts, those amounts, actually do have meaning, are understandable, and I can explain them in a sentence to the analysts. So maybe the objective is to put me out of business. The financials are so clear. I'm not worried about this anytime soon, but you know, think about the information conveyed. Yeah. I'm good for a little while. But just to think about that information that the analyst is going to pick up, and does it have meaning? Can we actually describe it?
Sue, just to check there, you gave the example of properties. Are you saying something such as, if I put it at value, then fine, I tell you it's at value and so on? What if a company has it at cost? Are you suggesting, so that you can compare the two, that one should, if it's at cost, should tell you the value, or the one at value should tell you the cost? And
I think there are certainly those within our organization that would say we need both, you know, full set of accounts, one on historical cost, one on fair value. I think that's probably unnecessarily complex, probably up to confuse matters, and certainly maintaining separate sets of books on different bases is difficult for companies. So I think we'd have to think carefully about the cost benefit on that. So no, I'm not suggesting that. But what I would say is, on the basis that has been selected, an understanding of why it's selected, why management believes that's the best portrayal of those assets, the most meaningful in relation to their business, that would be important. We do, as you know, adjust financial statements and calculating ratios and whatnot. So there probably would be some areas where it might be helpful to have additional disclosures, so accounting on one basis disclosure to provide additional information. But I think we would need to be a bit selective on that and have good reasons for requesting that information, good analytical reasons. So I wouldn't lay it out as a blanket.
Thanks, Sue. Benoit?
Yes, I think we were very impressed in FEE to see all the list of this measurement basis. But we do not feel guilty to have this so many bases of measurement, because we have to remind all the reasons for which this basis has been defined before making additional work in terms of reducing the number of measurement bases. So we have to go back to the basis of conclusion of each standards to remember what were these the reasons for each measurement basis. And these reasons were very good, in fact. So why to try to reduce to a limited number of measurement bases? I think that could be a conclusion.
Can you answer that question, Peter?
Yeah, thank you, David. I always feel slightly nervous taking part in these things because I feel a bit of an intellectual lightweight in the presence of so many people who understand what the Hicksian approach to measuring income is, which is a phrase I came across and I'm still grappling with. I think a number of comments have been made around the table which are very interesting. And I do think one of the central points is that it's very dangerous to say this is what users want. I think a comment was made that different users want different things under different circumstances. And I think that is absolutely true. And certainly, if you ask me sort of what I will want under certain circumstances, I'll give you a view. If you ask one of my equivalents at another investment bank, they might give you a slightly different view. So that is a problem. And I think allied to that, I do agree with the point that there is not one central truth. And I know, David, you've made the statement very clearly that the IASB is not heading for a full fair value balance sheet, and I'm very encouraged by that because, I don't think that. I think that's a holy grail that is both not wanted and not achievable. So I'm glad we're not headed there. I think the issues for users. I mean, I was interested by Robert. It was a comment you made earlier. And it brought to mind the sort of current catchphrase, am I bothered? And I thought, well, you know, if you ask users, are you bothered about the balance sheet? Large numbers of them would say, well, no, which may be worrying. And I would accept that criticism. But if you ask an analyst following sort of retail companies or an analyst following some sort of, you know, simple manufacturing company or whatever, do you look at the balance sheet when the results come out? As Ian was mentioning, you know, the sort of the 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, sort of rushing around to come up with a view in 30 minutes. Do the analysts in a lot of those businesses look at the balance sheet? Absolutely not. They just don't. Now, as I say, you could criticise them for that, and I think in certain circumstances you probably should, but that is the sort of commercial reality. And the capital markets seem to work quite well in spite of that perhaps rather superficial, rather ignorant approach. So I do think there's a risk that we are in danger of sort of rushing to solve a problem that isn't necessarily causing as much difficulty or capital markets inefficiency as we think perhaps it ought. So that, I think, is the first point. But I think there is then an add-on. If you ask a credit analyst, like the sorts of people that Sue is spending a lot of her time talking to, do they look at the balance sheet? Yes, absolutely, they do. If you ask a real estate analyst, does he or she look at the balance sheet? Yes, they certainly do. If you ask an autos analyst 2 months down the line after the results have come out, are they looking at the balance sheet? Well, yes, now they are, because now they've got the time and the interest to start thinking about the assets that are in use and the risks inherent in the business. So we've got to get to grips with the idea that there simply isn't a simple answer. I think that's really very, very important. And we can come up with a whole range of sort of philosophically valid reasons for picking one answer, but that will take us down the wrong track. Now, that's fair enough to say, well, there isn't a simple answer, and it would be invidious of me then to say, well, go on, David, go away and sort it out, and you're absolutely right to then come back and ask the question of users, well, have you got any suggestions? And I think actually if you do ask users what they want, they do want some sort of fair value, some sort of current value, and they're never really sure exactly how to measure that, but they do want some sort of up-to-date number for a lot of things. And financial instruments, under most circumstances, to take your points, Melissa, but I think in general, financial instruments, they'll want those at sort of fair value. They'll want real estate at fair value. And again, if you ask retail analysts today, do you want fair values? They'll say, oh yeah, Tesco's, they just securitized some. Well, what's the fair value? And they're all running around trying to work out the fair value of the supermarket assets. A year ago, they weren't interested. So there you have some useful information they could have done with. So, but if you ask them, what about the fleet of vans that Tesco use or Ocado use to deliver the shopping? Should those be at fair value? I'll say, well, why? I'm not really interested in the value of the van. I want to know how well management use the van to generate cash coming in from shoppers. So that's what investors are doing. They are applying a mixed mental model. And it has something to do, again, I think it was Andrew was mentioning the sort of input-output arbitrage, which is a rather inelegant phrase, but it's just a sort of slightly more difficult to understand way of explaining that analysts are trying to look at what businesses do. They're looking at activities, they're looking at transactions, they're looking at flows. And they want to try and differentiate assets that are used to facilitate those flows, those operations, where the actual value of the asset itself is not really very interesting. It's the flows that result that's key. And the flip side of that, then they're looking at other assets and liabilities, like pensions, or I mentioned real estate and others, where the value, today's value, is meaningful, perhaps because there is the possibility of selling the real estate or securitizing it or going to a buyout firm and actually settling that pension liability once and for all, or being forced to in an M&A situation or something like that. So that's not a complete answer. That doesn't actually sort of tell you where to draw the dividing line. But I do think the fundamental question is, are investors and analysts bothered about the balance sheet? Well, the very simplistic answer is no. And there is a big, big risk that we all in situations like this rush ahead in philosophical terms and start saying, right, well, we've got 19 different bases. We've got to cut that down. And I'd agree from a conceptual point of view. Why have 19 different ways of looking at things on the balance sheet? That sounds mad to me. Surely we can get away with one or two or three. But ask an investor, do you know there are 19 different bases? Well, they might think there are two, but they wouldn't realize there were 19. And actually, if you then describe them to you, they'd probably say, well, so what's the difference? So that, I think, is where we are in terms of investors. I think that means there's a degree of education to be done. And interestingly enough, I was at a conference this morning organized by one of the new pension buyouts firms talking about pension liabilities. And there is a very good example of an accounting standard that has rather led the way in terms of educating. But I think perhaps it might be better to do the educating before writing the standard. I think we sort of got away with it, and rightly so, with FRS 17 and IS 19 and how they're working in the markets there. But I think it would be better to try to actually explain to investors, if you like, you know, what they might be missing with the current accounting model before changing it for them. Because at the moment, if you say, are investors bothered, they'll say, well, yes, we are bothered by accounting changes. We're not bothered by the balance sheet, we're bothered by what the ISB is doing. And it may well be that they're actually operating from that sort of level of ignorance, and I think that will often be true. But the gut reaction is there's a lot of change. You know, why? I thought I understood companies before, and now I feel more ignorant. Now, actually, of course, that may simply be revealing the ignorance that was always there and they didn't know it. And I think that may be true in some circumstances. But you know, that is the potential risk, that we're actually at least appearing to make things more difficult for the capital markets, more inefficient by what we're ending up doing. So that's the sort of caution. No answers there, I'm afraid, David, and slightly rambling, I appreciate that.
Well, that's very helpful. Sylvie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, two points. The first on the number of measurement methods. The graphic you showed looks awful with all those colors, and I suspect it may have been done on purpose. But, well, in reality, maybe the situation is less worse than it is, because you can group those different type of valuation by big families who look more similar to one another. So that was the first point. The situation is not as worse as it seems to be. Then the second point relates to what Melissa said, which I appreciate very much, and also something that Peter just said about time, saying that now investors 2 years ago didn't care about fair value of some items, but now they are. And in fact, I guess the time is important, and the evolution of mentality and evolution of market is important as well in choosing a measurement, the right measurement methods. Melissa quoted two types of loan portfolio, one which is very actively traded, and for a bank who is very active in the securitization market, and the other one. It's true that for the first one, fair value might be interesting, and for the second one, which is not trade, I mean, fair value is just irrelevant. But because we don't have, in continental Europe at least, a very active market for loans, but it may be that in 2, 3, 10 years' time, we may have an active market for loans. And at that time, then fair value might be interesting and might be relevant and reliable. But I guess that the valuation, the measurement we choose, that's the reason why, as a banking supervisor, we're very keen about reliability, is that the measurement method should be close to the market and close to the evolution of the market and the price. If the time comes where we have very active market for loans, then maybe at that time, fair value for loans would be fine.
Melissa, are you trying to come in with... to comment on that point, or is... No, okay, sorry, I misunderstood. Neil?
I'm worried that we might be missing the point about fixed assets and cash-generating units. I think one of the things about most companies that the biggest part of enterprise value on most balance sheet is taken up by fixed assets, including land, tangibles, intangibles, and goodwill. And nearly all fixed assets fall into cash-generating units, and those that don't fall into an overhead cost center. And so... valuing the cash-generating units is quite important. Now, when a cash-generating unit or a group of cash-generating units are sold as a business, the price is it almost always or always? I think it's always fixed in relation to the fixed assets therein and adjusted by the amount of current assets that go with them. So standard setters can think of fixed assets as the components of cash-generating units. And fixed assets aggregate at several levels, you know, components make a machine, da-da-da-da-da, up into the highest level below the board is the business segments. And when analysts do a valuation of the company, typically they're doing a sum of the parts, valuing the business center, business segments. Importantly also, value creation activity takes place inside cash-generating units. Management manage by trying to improve the cash flows of cash-generating units by reducing their working weighted average cost of capital. And the sheer size of them makes it important that we deal with this part of it correctly. We've had a few comments around the table of appropriate to the type of asset and so on. And I think the difficulties usually are going to lie with fixed assets. So if we find an approach that works with fixed assets, it will be a big step forward. And I think the approach has got to be by looking at cash-generating units. In most instances, the best and highest use for the valuation of a fixed asset will be in use as part of the cash-generating unit to which it belongs. And the fair value of the fixed assets will therefore be the fair value of the cash-generating units to which they belong. But fixed assets do not fall into active markets, so you're never going to have a level one valuation for a group of fixed assets. You will occasionally have level two valuations, but more normally, the normal way approach to valuing fixed assets is either by saying the recoverable historic cost was because we know what this table cost and what that van cost. But when you talk about the values of fixed assets, you're going to be talking about the values of the cash generator units by discounting the cash flows that come from it. And so I think we've got to get used to the idea that when you talk about the appropriate basis of measurement for the most important part of the balance sheet, the fixed assets, you're going to have two concepts in your mind. You've got the original cost of those things which came to you as bits and pieces, a table, a chair, a factory, been added together into the value of your segments. Into the cost of your segments. But the value of those segments is a totally different concept by saying what are the cash flows that come out of the cash generating units in which these things belong. And that's the approach that you just adopt when you're doing M&A activity and trying to sell businesses. You don't look at what individual assets you have. You say, what cash flows does that group of assets generate?
So looking at the model, if I've got it right, Neil, that you're proposing is that your balance sheet would be a sort of section there dealing with, you know, widget manufacturing assets, and the present value of the cash flows from that would be one of the numbers. That would be the number you stick in. Is that right?
I think the key is going to be in the segmental reporting. The segmental reporting is really going to say, how can I value this business on the basis of its cash flows? That might not be individual cash-generating units, but business segments are going to be a collection of cash-generating units. And I think you would say that there are two things that you want to show in this. Analysts that want to look at where the cash has come from, where it's been applied, and get to objectivity would want to know the cost of those things, traditional historic recoverable historic cost, and you'll get that by aggregating all the fixed assets that make up business unit A, and then as a quite separate exercise, and that will be what normally features in the management accounts of your company, because the adjustments when you do the accounting are usually done at the end of a financial reporting period when you go away and do value in use or fair value calculations. And then you go away and you do that, you look at your cash flow forecast and say, well, the value in use of business A is a much bigger number than that, and then you can report those two figures. You've got the recoverable historic cost, what it cost me to acquire all these things, the top part of the balance sheet or first column, and then the difference between that and the fair value or value in use that I now calculate in the second part of it, and then the total will be the value in use. So I think the users that we talk about, not knowing what users want, that approach, I think, gives them everything they might conceivably want. They've got some objective data of essentially where the cash went, and they've got some subjective data, arguably, on values, but they've got both for everything.
Just to follow up, I thought part of your question that I don't think Neil got to was, Neil, in your model, would you just have one number for a cash-generating unit, or would you take that number, this is for a cash-generating unit, and then somehow get it down to buildings, machinery, and then some intangible, some goodwill, or whatever you want to call it, the synergy bit to make up the difference, or would you just have one number for that cash-generating unit?
No, you'd have three numbers. And you know, if you want to give more than three numbers, you can. But those three numbers are recoverable historic cost, what, fixed assets at cost less depreciation, effectively.
But she's saying one lump
for bits. So three numbers for each cash generating unit or for each business segment: the value in use, the recoverable historic cost, and the difference between them being the gain in value in use since acquisition. Well, no, the bits, you know, that depends on whether it's relevant. You know, it's management commentary and disclosure notes usefulness. If it's important to know that the cost is made up of the fact that we bought it from another company or that we acquired it bit by bit or whatever, then you'd put that into your notes. But that's for management discretion as to how you best describe what has happened, I think.
You were trying to come in.
Yeah, it seemed to me there were a number of comments about complexity and a concern about
the different measurement basis and cause of causing complexity. But at the same time, if we were to narrow that, there's also a fear that that could lead to everything on the balance sheet at fair value, and that's something you don't want either. And it seemed to me that having different measurement basis for different things doesn't cause complexity and may be okay. It's when it's the same thing, the same economic phenomena, that you could use and select different measurement basis. That's the thing that causes complexity, because we need some rules around that type of situation, or else it's accounting arbitrage and there's freedom to decide when you recognize something in earnings. And when I think of ISDA's comments on what they wanted, it seems to me that ISDA ought to tell us as well whether they're willing to accept the complexity, or do they also want the freedom to selectively recognize whatever they want in income. Because when I look at the list, long dated, that's something that maybe shouldn't be at fair value. Well, if I had it in my trading portfolio, I think I'd want it at fair value. But if we said that's going to be an option, some do, some don't, then we need bounds around it. Strategic's another one. How business is managed, we hear that a lot. And when I think of the example, well, someone securitizes, the other doesn't. But the one that doesn't, suppose they decide at the end of certain quarters when they need the pop that they do a securitization. Do they still get to pick? And so it seems to be one of the things we need to focus on is the issue of the same thing being measured differently and how we consider that in this. And maybe you could respond, Melissa, as to what is it that you guys are looking for?
I guess, first of all, what I would say from previous experience in dealing in particular with financial instruments is that you're right. You might have something that is a little bit more simple by having one basis that's the same for everything. And you would hopefully be able to eliminate arbitrage by having bright lines that say, okay, well, even if they're not all going to be the same, everything that looks like this is going to be treated like this regardless of circumstance. And I don't actually think that's what our members feel is the most appropriate. I do think that they would want some flexibility to make sure that they were selecting the option that was the most appropriate use of that asset or liability in their business. And I realize that there, you know, there still will need to be some boundaries around that. And I think we'd be very happy on the financial institution side in helping to look at those. And I also think that that will lead to a need for good disclosure around what has been selected, why it's been selected. In my personal opinion, if you say that you don't securitize, but then at the end of the quarter you do, that doesn't sound like the financial statements are really representing what you're really doing. And so I do think that having some boundaries is probably reasonable to ensure that there's not inappropriate management arbitrage, but I do think there's going to need to be flexibility in judgment, or you'll end up with things that are just as misleading because you're accounting for something one way and actually using it in the business in a completely different way. So.
I just wanted to sort of come back on this business of forecasting cash flows, because it's what analysts and investors say they're really trying to do, and certainly for most types of businesses that is actually true, and I think what analysts and investors want to be able to do is they want to be able to make their own estimates of future cash flows from the business, and then they want to value those cash flows, and that value will change periodically, even if the cash flow estimate doesn't. And what analysts and investors want to be able to do is they want to be able to get to that sort of, if you like, potentially unchanging estimate of cash flows, and then price it depending upon market circumstance at any particular point in time. What would potentially not be helpful, therefore, is to have somebody else with their own internal model pricing the cash flows for the analysts and sort of presenting them with a, whatever you want to call it, but a current value, a fair value, a mark to model or mark to market, that won't necessarily give the analysts and investors what they're actually trying to get hold of. An interesting example is pension liabilities. And again, just to go back to one of my favorite subjects at the moment. You know, pension liabilities for companies reporting December year ends, December 06, pension liabilities will look smaller this year than they did in 05. Why? Simply because the AA bond yield is now higher than it was a year ago. Now, most intelligent analysts and investors know that that is a relatively meaningless change. It's a spot value number on the 31st of December. That was the value, which actually tells you really nothing about the underlying cash flows, either out of the pension scheme itself or indeed the company's commitment to put cash in, which is ultimately what will have an impact on shareholders and, if you like, the potential dividends they can get out or what would happen in some sort of corporate restructuring or M&A or whatever. So that, I think, is just sort of one example where, you can have a fair value and you can say, well, that's how we calculate it and therefore that's what it means. And it gives you a meaningful result in terms of the balance sheet at that particular point. But it's not quite what analysts and investors are really trying to get hold of. They really want to understand the underlying business dynamics and the cash flows and then value those themselves. So if they're like, they want to be able to do an entity-specific valuation on any particular point in time. They really want more of the sort of the raw materials, and they don't necessarily want the water muddied by having the value presented to them. They're not just then going to add it up. So I think it's the cash flow that is really key, and that's a key piece of information that analysts and investors are trying to get to. And that also then ties in with this idea of trying to hold management accountable for what they're doing with the assets. Some managers are good at managing portfolios of assets, and others are less good. And again, it's very hard to actually sort of price that into a particular fair value. If you take a market value, a market value of a van or a piece of productive machinery or whatever is going to be the same right across the piece. But to the market, to the capital market, having those managers in charge of those assets is a different thing. So again, you really want to have an idea of, what is the potential productivity of that asset rather than what's the spot value today.